Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. H1N1 flu vaccinations began in several states this week, with priority given to children and healthcare workers. Over the coming weeks, millions of doses will become available, but some predict, at least initially, demand will exceed supply. Joining me to answer questions about the vaccines for the H1N1 flu and the seasonal flu, Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH. Bobby Pestrunk, he's executive director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, and joining us from a studio at Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Osterholm. He's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research. I know many of you have questions. We've already received email. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Dan.
Good to have you with us. Dr. Fauci, Tom Frieden, the head of the Centers for Disease Control, said we've not had a flu season like this in 50 years. What is that going to mean in terms of bumps along the road for the H1N1 vaccine?
Well, with regard to the H1N1 vaccine, it's being rolled out right now. We were in a situation where we first really isolated and noticed this new virus in April, and we started making a vaccine. We have the vaccine now made, and we're just starting the rollout. People are getting infected because even though this isn't, quote, the classical flu season yet, it's in the very early part, it's acting almost like it is in the middle of a flu season because of the widespread infections throughout the country. So we're in a bit of a race of getting, in a safe and measured way, the vaccine available to the people who could benefit for it at the same time is that there's a lot of infections going on. So that what he's referring to is a lot of aspects, the widespread nature and the fact that it's just early October and we're already seeing widespread infection. That's different than what we usually see.
Dr. Osterholm, what's the latest on the numbers of people actually contracting the H1N1 virus?
Well, first of all, we don't track cases of influenza typically in any given year. And this year, with the number of infections occurring, it would be even more difficult. But what we do is use measures that give us an indirect sense of that. For example, how many severe cases occur. And that is always measured by hospitalizations or the number of people requiring intensive care medicine. What kind of institutional experiences do we have? For example, schools, where we have 20 to 30% of the kids out of class. And when we look at those measures, we can tell you that we have widespread flu activity right now in at least 30 states around the country, flu activity everywhere, meaning that every state has it. And what we're seeing is a rather rapid increase in the number of cases occurring. In some states are now reporting the doubling of the number of schools reporting outbreaks every 3 to 5 days. So that I think that we're well on track here for seeing a potential peak in activity within the next 3 to 4 weeks,
so,
at least as we'd see through flu.
So far, have most of those cases been fairly mild?
Well, you know, one of the problems we have in describing this pandemic of H1N1 is we talk about it as a mild pandemic, and for over 99% of the people, that is the case. They may be sick for 3 to 5 days. They may sure feel like they've been hit by a truck, but they recover, do well, get back into the workforce or the schools or wherever. But for a smaller percentage of cases, less than 1%, it's much more severe disease. And in those instances, this actually has resulted in a number of very serious illnesses, including the deaths that we've talked about, and the fact that we are challenging a number of the intensive care units around the country right now with almost filling their capacity. Mm-hmm. And if we go over the top of that capacity, then I think we're going to be in pretty big trouble.
Dr. Fauci.
Yeah, and one of the differences between this and the standard seasonal flu is when you talk about serious disease leading to hospitalization and deaths of the 36,000 people each year who die of seasonal flu, greater than 90% of them are in individuals older than 65 years old, and most of them around 80 or older. The serious disease that Dr. Osterholm is talking about is concentrated generally in younger individuals, and that's one of the concerns.
Huge change.
Yes, that's
huge,
very different change from seasonal flu.
Now, what about the distribution, Bobby Pestrunk, the whole question of how the vaccine gets distributed to states, how they pay for it with budget cuts, how is it paid for? How is it going to make it?
Well, we actually have a couple of different challenges, Diane, in this particular season now. It's kind of a double whammy, and it's a perfect storm. It's a double whammy because we have both seasonal flu and H1N1 to deal with. And as Tony has said and Michael has said, these are coming on top of one another. And so that's the double whammy. The perfect storm is that we're in the middle of a recession. We're in the middle of an epidemic. We have imperfect communications with people across the country about what the nature of the epidemic is and what people should do about it. And we have many medically homeless people who don't know where to go for care if they need it. We have a healthcare system that, quite frankly, is broken for a lot of people. And the financing that's necessary to do the planning, to make sure that vaccine gets to where it needs to go, and to make sure that vaccine gets into the arms of people, isn't really there on any kind of consistent basis. And the recession and the economic troubles in the country at the federal, state, and local level are reducing the number of people in local communities who are actually there to put shots in people's
arms.
So
how much has the federal government allotted for distribution, and how much of a burden then falls to the states themselves?
The federal government is making vaccine, H1N1 vaccine, available so that no one needs to pay for the vaccine itself. There still can be administrative costs that people who want H1N1 vaccine will have to pay. The seasonal flu, which is a separate vaccine and in a separate distribution system, is being handled in the typical way that it has been. Providers who are going to deliver that vaccine will have to pay for it. They have put orders in ahead of time for it, and it's being distributed as people have ordered it. And that in itself is causing problems in many local communities where vaccine is not available to people who want it. I traveled last week to a number of states around the country to talk with them in part about both H1N1 and seasonal flu. And what's been happening in local communities, at least in terms of local health departments, is that they have slowly been getting out of the vaccination business as private providers in the big box stores, whether they're grocery stores or pharmacies, have gotten into the business. And others have seen it fit to provide vaccine. And so they've been reducing the orders that they've been placing for seasonal flu vaccine. This season, now in the fall, what they're saying is that demand is up for seasonal flu, and people are coming in to all of these different venues to get their shots. And in the first wave, they're basically, in some states now, in some local health departments, out of seasonal flu.
Right.
And they're waiting for shipments of new vaccine. Mm. So we've got this imperfect balance between this increasing demand for vaccine on the one hand.
Imperfect balance in the midst of a perfect storm, Dr. Fauci.
It's tough, and you know, I think Bobby described it very well. There are challenges. I think we're going to get through it. I think particularly as the vaccinations, the H1N1 vaccines, start to roll in right now, we had to make a decision whether we would accumulate it in a sort of warehouse fashion and then distribute it to everyone that needed, or get the doses out as they came in. And that's what the decision was made. And that's why you heard yesterday and the day before about the 600,000 or so doses of H1N1, mostly the flu mist, that were made available. By the end of the week, we'll be up to several million. And then by the following week, we'll start to get the rollout of tens of millions coming in.
Let's talk about that flu mist, because there are an awful lot of questions about it, whether it really works, whether it will do the job, whether individuals who get that flu mist will then later have to have the vaccine injection.
Well, the answer to the first question is that it does work. There's no doubt that FluMist works. It works. It's administered in a different way, but it works as well as the injectable. There's no doubt. The bracket of people for whom it's indicated is 2 years old to 49 years old. There are some people who should not get it, like pregnant women, people with asthma, people with respiratory difficulties. So there are some constraints on it, but it is a good vaccine.
How does it differ from the injectable?
Well, the injectable is what we call an inactivated or a killed vaccine,
yes,
where you inject the components. The FluMist is an attenuated live vaccine that you spray into the nose, but it's adapted that it could only replicate in the nose because it's cold adapted. So it doesn't have any chance at all of giving you flu as a disease, but it induces a potent immune response.
Anybody worried about that, Bobby?
I think that there are many people who are worried, and I think that's one of the main communication challenges that we have this season. And I think it points, this is not, both the nasal vaccine and the injectable vaccine are not new vaccines. And I think that one of the challenges we have in the midst of this present crisis in the fall and the winter is to recognize that there is an annual problem in this country. As Dr. Fauci indicated earlier, there are 36,000 people who die from flu on an annual basis. We have not created the system that allows and affords everyone the opportunity to be vaccinated annually. And if we had that system in place, we wouldn't be facing some of the challenges that we are right now.
Bobby Pestrunk, he's Executive Director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials. We'll take just a short break and right back. We're back trying to answer the hundreds of questions that are out there about H1N1, the vaccine, the particular kind of flu. Here is an email from Aaron who says, I want to find out when the results are expected for the NIH trials of the swine flu vaccine in pregnant women. It's my understanding they started the week of September 10th. I am pregnant, due in December. I fully intend to get the swine flu vaccine, but if I knew the results of the trial were due soon, I may decide to wait a week or two. Dr. Fauci.
Well, the final results will be ready by the end of October. But I want to make a point that I think is not very well appreciated, Diane, is that this vaccine is strikingly similar to the seasonal flu vaccine made by the same companies with the same processes and the same materials.
Then why are so many people worried
about it?
Well,
I mean, that we need to get that message out. And we have years of experience with the seasonal flu vaccine in pregnant women with a very, very good safety record and the induction of a protective response. So in that respect, it really isn't a new vaccine, even though people seem to interpret that it is.
Dr. Osterholm?
Yeah, Diane, I think that this is a very important point. And as Tony's alluded to here, the studies that we're doing now are not really about safety in the sense that beyond the immediate reaction that we would see of a very high percentage of people, would we pick this up? We're really trying to work on what is the dosage that we need in these people to make sure that they're protected when they get their vaccination. And I think that the really important point here is that for the past several decades, we've been giving between 100 million and now up to close to 250 million doses of this influenza vaccine annually to people around the world. And it really has an amazing track record of safety during that time, and this vaccine is no different than that. I think the problem we're engaging here is really a three-pronged problem that is beyond just is it safe or not. We have one group of people who want the vaccine right now. They're very anxious to get it, and I worry, as Bobby so well detailed, that they're not going to be able to get it because of the distribution problems. It's not that the pipeline isn't working right now, but we have a very rusty faucet at the end of that pipeline in terms of no system to deliver it in any meaningful way. The second thing is we have a whole group of people that are waiting on the fence, and they're waiting on the fence basically to get more information or to see that a bunch of people got it and it seemed to be okay. And, of course, that means that they're not protected then during that time period. In addition, they're the people who are going to be hearing from the media in the short term that people are having heart attacks, they're having miscarriages and everything after getting the vaccine, which is not at all related to the vaccine in the sense that we'd expect every day 200,000 American women will have spontaneous abortions at just as an occurrence of life. And so surely some of them are going to have been vaccinated in the previous 2 days. We'll see 1,000 people a day having heart attacks. So I think the point being is that we have to be very careful here about that group, whether they'll come or not. The third group, which I really worry about the most, and frankly there are far too many physicians and nurses that are in this group who are just adamantly against this vaccine, almost bordering on anti-vaccine.
Really?
And they're making statements out there that are absolutely unprofessional.
Why do you suppose that's being done?
Well, I think it's out of ignorance in part and to some degree their own personal agendas. They feel like they're being told they have to get the vaccine, so they don't want to get the vaccine. So the way not to get the vaccine is to suggest it's not safe. And we've had an ongoing battle with healthcare workers to get this vaccine over the years because we want to protect their patients.
All right.
We're obviously interested in protecting them. But we're seeing, I think, a real anti-vaccine movement with this issue too, which doesn't take into account the safety data and the impact of not vaccinating the population.
Bobby.
This is an annual problem, Diane, and I think what H1N1 has revealed to us is the nature of that annual problem. We have seasonal flu every year, and the fact is that most people don't get vaccinated for seasonal flu. Even the people that we recommend get vaccinated don't get vaccinated. And I think in part it's because this challenge of convincing people to be vaccinated is the result of the fact that people know about things in a lot of different ways, and they're convinced about things in a lot of different ways. They know, some people know because the methods of science tell them that that's the right way to know. Others know because they hear a story or they have a friend that tells them what the right thing to do is. And we have incomplete ways of reaching each of these different populations to convince them about what we know about vaccine, that it is a safe and proven method of preventing disease.
Here is an email from Alexander, who says, as the parent of two school-aged children, I'm extraordinarily concerned with the increasing prevalence of the H1N1 virus. I have a handful of quick questions. One, is the recommendation for children under 9 years old still a series of two shots? Dr. Fauci.
That answer is correct. It is two shots for younger children.
All right. While the initial reports on immunogenicity have been positive, what, if any, serious adverse events have been documented, given that the design of at least one of the trials has an assessment of adverse events 21 days after the last dose?
There are no serious adverse events in the clinical trials that have been sponsored by the NIH that could be directly related to the vaccination. What we're seeing in a reasonable proportion of people is what you'd expect when you inject something into the arm of an individual like a vaccine, is some redness, some pain, some swelling, occasionally fever, but rarely.
So
but with regard to serious adverse events that could be directly related to the vaccination, we're not seeing that.
Dr. Strohholm, are there any safety concerns about this vaccine that you are concerned about, or are you more concerned with people who need it who don't get it?
Well, first of all, as any responsible scientist, we have to say that we always have to be vigilant for some safety issue that we just can't imagine could happen, but did happen. We saw that in 1976, and we've learned a lot about the whole vaccine issue since that time. But to say that we're concerned about a safety issue because we think it might happen is not the case. As again, I pointed out, and Tony's pointed out, we've given this vaccine, a very similar one, to hundreds of millions of people over the years and have not seen the problem. What I'm concerned about is this unfortunate relationship that will be placed by some in the media, I think surely the anti-vaccine folks, that if anything occurs in the 24 to 72 hours after a vaccine is delivered, it's going to be labeled as cause and effect. That is not the case. Where there's massive efforts by the federal government, and I give the CDC and the Health and Human Services Department great credit for putting in place a system to quickly ascertain this information, to compare it to what we'd expect to see in terms of patients by age and location, and to say, is this anything out of the norm, and then to get that information out back to the public.
I wonder how long this whole distribution process is going to take. My husband and I went to our own doctor earlier this week. She said that the vaccine is here in Washington, but the district government has to decide how it's going to be distributed. Is that how it's going to go around the country? Each jurisdiction, each county, each state is going to make that decision?
Yes, it is. In part, that is the way it will work. And I think if it makes some sense that it will work that way. The constellation of resources and the people and organizations that can provide vaccine in any given community differ. And so one needs to have an overlay of local management of the vaccine. In addition, with the H1N1 vaccine, because it's coming out in lots and not all at once, decisions have been made that it's important to vaccinate certain people first. So, for example, there's been a lot of attention to having healthcare workers vaccinated first, to having people who have underlying health conditions vaccinated first, and to protect also children and pregnant women first. And in that case, the vaccine has to be distributed carefully around the community to make certain that it's getting to those populations first.
What is the total percentage, Dr. Fauci, of the population that must be vaccinated in order to prevent spread?
Well, let me answer it in a different way. If you look at the five target groups that we feel would need the vaccine for a variety of reasons, and we mentioned pregnant women and younger children, et cetera, that's about 159 to 160 million people. When you talk about what I think you're referring to is that what percentage of the population do you need to get herd immunity, namely enough people, that really varies with the virus involved, with the efficiency of spread of the virus. It usually is a somewhat of a large majority of the population that could protect the others. In some diseases in which it doesn't spread very well, you may need a minor proportion of the population. With influenza, particularly this influenza that spreads so efficiently, you would need a substantial proportion of the population to get that herd immunity.
How does this particular virus spread?
Well, it spreads by the classic route that influenza viruses spread, through the respiratory droplets and aerosol, hand contact, rubbing your nose and your eyes. If you sneeze into your hand and then you rub your eyes, or someone shakes hands with you and you rub your eyes or nose.
Are you recommending not shaking hands these days? You shook my hand.
I did. Well, that's you, Diane.
Yeah,
that's you.
Right. Okay, let me read you this, because I think it does represent a lot of people out there. He's listening. Tony is listening from Canyon Lake, Texas. He said, this is just a hype of fear in order to get people to use the vaccines. I'm just going to shut you off for the day. I refuse to listen to any more hype. I'm 62 years old, have kept in fairly good health in spite of being disabled, and have never had a flu shot. Yeah, I got the flu, but guess what? That just gets my immune system working to make its own antibodies. Diane, I think your show is usually very good, but not this one, so goodbye for today. And Dr. Osterholm, what's your reaction?
Well, this is the same kind of person that says, because I've never had an accident, there's no reason why I should wear a seatbelt, because it doesn't do me any good except get in the way. The bottom line is that there are hundreds of millions of people around the world who've already had this infection. The number will get into the billions, I believe. In this country, surely, we see an increasing number of infections, and we've already stated very clearly that for the vast majority of these people, this will be a relatively minor event in their life. They'll be sick for a few days. Absenteeism will be important in the workplace. It'll be important in schools and so forth. But the bottom line is that there is a very small percentage, but today with the large population we have of younger people who will have a very serious illness. Ask the over 100 people who have died from this, where we actually have the data to show that, you know, that in fact this was a very serious kind of infection that's different than we typically think of in many cases with flu. I think the death numbers now are nationwide well over 600. They're climbing, and I think you're going to see that. But even more importantly, in the intensive care units of this country, we are challenging a number of local areas just to keep these people alive. And again, as I pointed out, as we get more cases, we may very well go over the top of the levee with the floodwaters of cases there. And that, if you've ever been in one of those situations, in which I'd welcome this gentleman to go see, tell me that there's hype around this.
All right.
And that's the problem. He just hasn't seen it.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show, and we'll open the phones now. First to Frederick, Maryland. Good morning, Addison. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I find it passing strange about one fact. I used to live in South America. Seasons have passed. The flu season, which is traditionally winter, it's over. They're in the spring. We've heard nothing. We heard something at the beginning, but we hear nothing about how many people got sick. They didn't have the vaccine. There's a billion people down there. Why don't we get this information? I might understand it politically, and there is no journalism left in America, not much.
All right. Well, you're going to get that information right now, Dr. Fauci.
Well, the Southern Hemisphere, and we've been monitoring in collaboration with the health departments of those countries, countries like Argentina, Chile, South Africa, New Zealand, and Australia, they have had a severe H1N1 season because they have just finished their winter. So they are now coming to the end of their flu season, not quite over yet. And they've had some serious difficulties. They've had widespread infections.
What does that mean in terms of numbers? Do we know?
Well, you know, we don't have exact counts, but they're talking about, you know, anywhere from 20 to plus 20 to 30% of the population getting infected. As we have seen, the pattern is essentially the same as we saw in the United States in April. For the most part, it's been a mild to moderate disease, but they still have that small percentage of people, again, young people. About 70% of which have underlying disease are the ones that get into trouble, but about 30% of the people that get hospitalized and die don't have any noticeable underlying conditions, which is worrisome because it's attacking, as we said in the earlier part of the show, preferentially younger individuals. So they're seeing on a widespread basis in the Southern Hemisphere what we saw a glimpse of in the spring in our own country and what we will likely see now as we enter the fall and the winter in this country.
But it sounds as though you're saying they had no vaccine.
Right.
They experienced exactly what we are likely.
No, we will hopefully, and that's what we're talking about this morning.
Okay.
That's what Bobby and Mike and I are talking about, is that you can intervene and you can do something about this by getting people vaccinated, particularly the people who are at higher risk for complications. And that's what we'd like to see, to add something in that armamentarium to blunt the spread of this virus.
Well, Addison,
also, Diane,
I sure hope that satisfies you as for information coming out about the Southern Hemisphere. Quickly, Dr. Osterholm.
Yeah, I just think another very important point here is that we're obviously talking about the United States, but today many of the critical products, many of the medicines, many of the medical supplies that we use every day in this country come from somewhere outside the United States. And we've just done a study looking at the 15 top importing countries into the United States. And if you look at all the government vaccine orders for those countries, that accounts for less than 2% of their population, meaning that, in fact, for much of the world, vaccine will not be available, which is going to have a direct impact on us. And so I think that one of the things we have to look at is this is a pandemic. It's a worldwide event. It's not just ours. Our vaccine will limit the impact of infection here, but we're still going to be in some hurt here as this thing unfolds.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Short break, more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Subsidy Scope project provides information about federal subsidies across industries at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
The meaning of justice. A Harvard political philosopher applies concepts of virtue and the common good to broad economic and civic concerns. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. Go right to the phones. To Banner Elk, North Carolina. Good morning, Rita. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, panel. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make, I guess, two comments. One, that in the early 1980s, the vaccine manufacturers made an argument to the Food and Drug Administration that if quality control requirements were enforced for large batches of the polio vaccine, that there would be a serious shortage of the polio vaccine. FDA then decided to waive those quality control standards. The vaccines were sent out anyway, and as a consequence, many children and their adult relatives with, I suppose, compromised immune systems contracted polio. So what I want to know is, can anybody really assure us that this won't happen again?
Dr. Osterholm.
Yeah, this is urban legend. Yeah. There's absolutely no truth to that whatsoever.
But wait a minute. Hold on. What about Guillain-Barré syndrome?
Well, Diane, that's not the point she's asking. She's
asking
about
polio, she's asking,
and I just want to be sure
polio.
That we have a factual statement here,
okay.
that never happened.
Right? Okay.
That's urban legend, okay? And I think that's important. There's a whole different issue about right. a live virus vaccine like polio causing right. potential infection in a contact of a vaccinee.
Okay.
There's no truth to that. Guillain-Barré syndrome actually did happen in 1976. I was very much a part of that investigation. One out of 100,000 people that got vaccinated, in fact, did get Guillain-Barré syndrome. And we've learned a lot from that experience. And I can just tell you with absolute certainty, as someone outside the government watching very carefully, there has never been a shortcut taken right. with any of the seasonal flu vaccines now or any of the H1N1 vaccines that are being used in this country.
Dr.
Absolutely
Fauci.
Has not happened.
Well, just to reinforce that, I believe that if the caller had finished her sentence, she was going to say, how can you guarantee that there are no shortcuts that are being taken with this? And the answer is there are none. It was done in a very measured way. And in fact, seasonal influenza vaccines don't even go through the kinds of trials that we're putting this H1N1 in.
All right. Well, let's follow up with that question from Helen in Reston, Virginia. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate having the chance to talk.
Sure. Go ahead.
Doctors. I did have either Guillain-Barré or Epstein-Barr in... I guess it was 76, and I did have a full-body paralysis except for respiratory on up.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, it was an interesting experience.
Yeah, I bet.
And led me to enjoy my life much more because I did recover. But coming to today, and I hope that my statement does not become part of one of these urban legends because I really appreciate the amount of medical concern and care that these gentlemen and that most of the medical profession is really exerting on this.
So your question
is, I have been told by one doctor to take the flu vaccine, and I have been told by another doctor to not take it because of my medical history. And the there is a... exception out on, I think that it's just the standard flu vaccine that has come out that says, that gives a warning on that. So if the doctors could let me give me information about where I could read this for myself.
Dr. Osterholm.
Actually, this is one I'd flip to Tony. I think you
well,
can comment
you know,
on the Guillain-Barré syndrome aspect of it
yeah.
from a safety perspective.
Here's where you talk about an abundance of caution, and I could understand where she may get conflicting recommendations from physicians. So if indeed, and it sounds like it was the case, that she had Guillain-Barré in 1976, and I would imagine, I think she was inferring that that was as a result of the vaccination that she received in 1976. So in an abundance of caution, if that in fact was associated with the vaccination, I as a physician, not as a public policy, would probably recommend to her that she not get vaccinated because
right.
she has that history.
Helen, I hope that helps and that you stay well. Let's go now to Sylacauga, Alabama. Good morning. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Eric?
Yeah, you did a good job.
Good. Eric, so. Thank you.
You got the name of the city right and my name wrong.
Good. Derek. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is, are there any possible genetic repercussions for our children's children as far as not being able to fight off future viruses that may mutate?
Interesting question. Dr. Fauci.
I'm not really sure what he means, any implications for his children's children. Genetically, it is very clear that there are genetic differences in the ability to respond in an immunological way, your body's defenses to particular infections. And that's just what we call polymorphism or variability among the genetic makeup of individuals, that some have a greater capability of responding to certain types of infections. If in fact, and forgetting influenza, this could be any type of infection. I mean, we know, for example, that with HIV infection, that there is a certain haplotype, we call it, or a genetic background where people seem to do much, much better if they're infected and there being ability to control the infection. I'm sure that holds true for a variety of other infections. If that's the case, then since it's genetic background, then you probably would be transmitting it down through genetically your children and your children's children.
Bobby.
Vaccines are one of the remarkable success stories of public health endeavor in this country and in the world. And nobody, I think, would argue that we should not be vaccinating people for the range of childhood and other illnesses that we do. And the way in which we have addressed the need to continue to have people protected against these diseases from one generation to the next, as we've had these vaccines, is to assure that people continue to be vaccinated.
Here is a follow-up on exactly that. This from Marin in Bethesda, Maryland. She says, I'm 24 weeks pregnant. In talking with other pregnant friends, we all agree it's not ideal to be pregnant during a pandemic. My doctor insists I get the H1N1 and seasonal flu vaccine. I've read details on the CDC website. I know it's very important to get both shots, but it seems there's no way to know until about 10 or more years from now what the impact of the vaccine might be on the babies born in 2009 and 2010. Some pregnant women may roll the dice and just hope they don't get sick rather than taking those vaccines. Dr. Fauci.
Well, I mean, that's an obvious reasonable concern, but let me just give you some facts about what we know. Again, as we've mentioned on the show before, Mike and I and Bobby all have mentioned that we have experience with influenza vaccines in pregnant women for decades, and there's no indication whatsoever that there's any adverse effect on the fetus of a mother who gets vaccinated during pregnancy. So the scientific data argue against there being any concern about that. The look at the risk-benefit of being vaccinated, high on the list of people who could benefit from the H1N1 vaccine as well as the seasonal flu vaccine are pregnant women. If you look at the complications that are associated with influenza, from what we've seen in our own country in the spring, is that pregnant women have about a 5 or 6 times greater chance of getting into trouble requiring hospitalization than non-pregnant people. Because if you look at the total number of people who would require hospitalization, pregnant women are overrepresented in that group. So the risk is considerable. And when you balance risk-benefit, you have to go on the side of getting vaccinated for
all
a pregnant woman.
To Manning.
Diane, sir.
Go right ahead.
To that, yes.
Sure.
Just to take all this information we've been talking about, and me as a scientist, knowing what I know, my daughter, who is a pediatrician at the University of Minnesota, is 6 months pregnant with my first grandchild. I cannot wait for her to get this vaccine. So if there was any sense that I had any concern about the impact on my new grandson that's coming or on my daughter, I'd be the first one to say, well, let's wait. I have just absolutely the opposite sense. I just can't wait for the moment she gets that shot.
And I can't wait for the moment you have a healthy grandchild. Dr. Osterholm, congratulations. Let's go to Shay in Manning, South Carolina. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have two questions. First, all three of my children have already had confirmed cases of H1N1 about 2 weeks ago. And I have been told from some people that there's no need for them to get the H1N1 vaccine. And then others say we've already had it, so we don't need to get the vaccine. And I had one other question. While my children were sick, I was trying to determine how long they should stay out of school before I sent them back. And the paperwork we got from the school from DHEC said that they should be away from other people for 24 hours after their fever has gone. But I read on the CDC website that children can actually remain contagious longer than that. And I was just wondering what the recommendation really is to keep from spreading the disease.
Dr. Fauci.
Well, we have to be careful when you say confirmed case of H1N1, and I think that's really the issue that a lot of people have faced. Unless she has a laboratory absolute confirmation that the children were infected with H1N1.
Did you, Shay?
I had a nasal swab done, which confirmed that it was, they told me H1N1.
Now, a nasal swab will not tell you if it's H1N1. You have to get a much more sophisticated test to show that. The point I'm making is that you can make an assumption that they received the H1N1.
How do you diagnose H1N1 and differentiate between ordinary flu?
There are tests that are molecular tests. There are tests that are specific antibody tests. They are not generally available in a clinic that you could just walk into to make the differentiation. So she may have been infected with a respiratory infection at a time when there was wide circulation of H1N1, and you can make a reasonable assumption that it was H1N1. But to be absolutely certain, you'd have to find a test that the CDC or a related type of a group could do. So the bottom line is, unless you're absolutely certain, you should get the H1N1 vaccination.
This is actually the reason, Diane, why the recommendations are for people to get their seasonal vaccine first and get that out of the way, so that if then they come down with an illness, perhaps a presumption can be made that it's H1N1 with which they're infected. But most people, unless they're seriously ill or are in a hospital, won't be given this more sophisticated test that Dr. Fauci has talked about.
And Dr. Osterholm, to answer her last question, how long should a child stay out of school after experiencing this flu?
Well, this is has been a moving target. So if people are confused by this, that's reasonable. Initially, there was a thought that you had to stay out at least 7 days after you were exposed to the virus or that you actually recovered. And as we've looked at this more carefully and trying to develop a practical response, meaning we could keep everybody, you know, away from other people for days after the infection, it really has come upon the conclusion that if you are away from other people for 24 hours after your fever breaks and you're not on fever-reducing medication like aspirin or Tylenol or anything like that, that the amount of virus that you might be excreting, even if you are, is so low that the potential for transmission is just difficult to measure. So we feel very confident and comfortable in this issue of 24 hours after the fever is broken, that the ability for that person to go back into the mainstream is okay.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Connie. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a simple question. If almost 50% of my daughter's classmates have already been out with what they were told was H1N1, it was certainly the flu, and it's not regular flu season yet, she has not been sick. The vaccine's not available for us yet, but it will be probably next week. Should I still get her vaccinated, or hasn't she already been exposed and fought it off?
She should absolutely be vaccinated when she has the opportunity to be vaccinated, and she should be vaccinated both for the seasonal flu and also for H1N1
vaccine. Should there be a time lapse between being vaccinated for ordinary flu and H1N1?
We actually are in the process of doing a study on that, and the preliminary data indicate that there really is no interference between those two. So if you do them
both
at the same time. But the one thing you can't do is you can't have the flu mist of one with the flu mist of the other. So you, for example, if you wanted to get the seasonal flu vaccine with the H1N1 vaccine, if you're getting the aerosolized flu mist, you can't do it at the same time. If you get the injectable, you can put the injectable for the H1N1 in one arm and the seasonal flu in the other. But you can do it, and they won't interfere with each other.
Are we absolutely certain, Dr. Fauci, that the aerosolized version of the H1N1 vaccine is equally effective as the injectable?
The track record is that they are comparable. You always use words like absolutely certain. The answer is very, very confident that plus or minus a couple of percentage points, they are comparable.
We have experience in the spring knowing that only certain children in certain classrooms became infected. And we know that for one reason or another, other children are also susceptible to it. And I think that's the experience that we will have, and it's the one that the caller has suggested. People may get infected during one wave of H1N1 or of seasonal flu, and yet they may... The children who haven't been infected are still susceptible to being infected.
And finally, Dr. Osterholm, in about 20 seconds, how worried are you about the H1N1?
Well, Diane, that's one that it's from where you stand is what you see, meaning that if you're part of that group of people who have relatively mild illness, it's not a big deal. But if you are dealing with the public where you just lost your healthy six-year-old child to this illness, it's a travesty. So I think that what we're really looking at here is how do we get public to say we can do a lot about these few cases that we're having now right now that are very serious. And that's what we're talking about here today, how to get this vaccine out.
Thank you all so much, Dr. Michael Osterholm, Bobby Pestrunk, Dr. Anthony Fauci, for bringing us as much information as you have now. We'll wait for more. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.